Welcome to the Research Reimagined podcast, brought to you by Nottingham Trent University. I'm your host, Helen Darby Dowman, and I'll be inviting some of NTU's brightest minds to explore how their research is helping us to deepen our understanding of the world. From online addictions to transgender rights and sleep disorders, listen as we discuss some of society's most pressing challenges and uncover some of the ways our research is making a difference. In this episode, we're delving into the wonders of space and exploring the intersections between science, art and culture. We're joined by Dr. Dan Brown, an astronomer here at NTU, who oversees the university's observatory and planetarium. We spend nearly half of our time under the open sky. It's a canvas that has inspired humanity since the beginning of time. But how does it influence us? And how do we engage with the sky? Dan will be guiding us through the connections we have as humans with the sky and the creative genius of individuals like Lord Byron, who passed away 200 years ago today. Lord Byron was a major figure of the Romantic movement and is regarded as being among the greatest of English poets. He penned the haunting poem Darkness during a time of celestial upheaval. But what was happening in the sky during Byron's era, and how did it shape his writing? But Lord Byron isn't the only one captivated by the sky at that time. Other writers immortalised it in their craft and were inspired by the Year Without a Summer in 1816, a chilling consequence of volcanic eruptions which altered our view of the sky and left a mark on history and inspired creative minds. From dating historical events based on celestial phenomena to winding back time with our knowledge of the stars, Dan will help us to uncover how key actors in space guide our understanding of the sky and how they can inspire us as writers and artists. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Can you just start off with telling us a little bit about how we perceive the sky to influence us as humans?
So it is, if you're thinking about it, a considerable influence because 50%, more or less, of our time, we see the sky in some form or manner. And even nowadays, that influences us. And if you don't think so, just consider buying a house and then considering one of them is south-facing, one of them is north-facing in our hemisphere. And at that point, you realize very quickly, the sky has us at the money already there and then. Or if you go just back to things like the International Space Station flying over, or for those of the listeners that are a bit older might recall the moon landing or that part, which is all part and parcel of our sky engagement. But that goes much deeper, sort of peering into the night sky and being able to see all the stars that are out there and the Milky Way. And that's reflected way back in time as well. And there's instances, if I just pick that up, in the beginning of the 19th century, where people explored the Milky Way and Herschel being one of them. And he expressed quite nicely the view which started to sort of shape of the world island, that there weren't galaxies about, we just knew about the stars and we thought they were all clustered in what's known our Milky Way. And his idea was that it's very clearly, if they're consisted evenly scattered out of stars, so the end is imminent, because he observed loads of these stars coming together as clusters, and it was just an overall result that the Milky Way would crumble into these clusters and fade away and die. So something that seems so infinitely everlasting is actually there, doomed to disappear. And stars overall are fascinating anyway, because if you assume the stars are like our sun, they're just much further away. And people at that time, Huygens starting off a good 100 years before that even, and then that was all picked up by Gregory and Newton, trying to have at least a guess, an educated guess, how far away they were. And they came up with distances that were in the lines of what we would call light years. So how long light is a year that it travels, that whole distance is one light year. And they came up with the brightest star would be something like a handful of light years away from us, which is already incomprehensible in a sense by thinking about how faint stars are then as well. So they're just unbelievably far away. And again, Herschel taunted one of the poets at that time by saying that if you're looking into the sky, you're probably seeing a sky full of ghosts. So they're actually not really there because it's taken so long for the light to arrive. So you can imagine people at that time that were knowledgeable enough or heard about some of the newest discoveries would have looked into the skies and would have seen emptiness, voids, and what is there is just doomed to die.
that's all very dramatic. And that's often what we hear about with the sky. Certainly when we're talking about kind of artistry and poems, you can see how it really influences kind of creativity. We're obviously talking today a bit about Byron, because it's the anniversary of Byron's death. And he wrote a poem in 1817 about the darkness, which was a product of the year with no summer. Could you tell us a bit about this and what was happening in the world that was impacting the sky around that time?
I mean, the poem itself is quite dramatic, and you said that's sort of what's come out of what I've described beforehand, and that's what was described just a few years beforehand, sort of the end of the Milky Way. And I think that's quite captured. So when Byron writes, "I had a dream which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless, pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the darkening air. Morn came and went, and came and brought no day, and men forgot their passion in the dread of this, their desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer of light." And it just goes on from that, and it just encapsulates this kind of doom, blackness, darkness. And if you think it's only the sky, so if you're not interested in that, you would have not had any contact with that. That's not the case. This has been written in the year without summer, as it's called, and very dramatic, because it is dramatic, because that year showed the coldest summer on record. It showed horrific thunderstorms, failed crops. We had a massive typhoid outbreaks in the UK as well. And all of that ties together with other astronomical aspects. So, for example, the sun, which was observed already quite a lot, showed sunspots, but not a lot in this kind of morn dominion. It was quite quiet. But in that year, there were monstrous sunspots to be seen. Monstrous meaning they were at sunrise or sunset through the glow of the atmosphere. You could safely see them, and you could see these big blobs without the guide of a telescope. And they are humongous indeed. So that motivated another astronomer over in Italy to propose that's the sign of the sun now dying. That's it. So they gave a date on the 18th of July. So they required troops in Austria and other places to sort of settle down crowds that were in panic. So that's the kind of feel in which things were happening in that year. And Byron decided to have, as you would do at that time as a poet, a bit of a soiree and a few picnics, and just chill out for the summer at a lake with his friends. And he went to Lake Geneva. But apart from wanting to swan around and peruse the lake, he was reined in because it was catastrophic, humongous thunderstorms that beautifully find their way in his writing as well, and in some of the writings of other of their guests. So he invited Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, John Polidori, Claire Clement, so quite a few. And for those in the know, you'll pick out there, for example, the writers of novels like Frankenstein, or key influences that will later lead on to Bram Stoker's Dracula. So all of these people were there, but just reined in. And at that point, if you're reined in, what can you do? So Byron picked out an anthology of ghost stories and started reading them, and inspired the writers there. Why don't you come up with your own ghost story? So that's what sort of went on about in that time, and specifically with Byron there as well. And darkness is written at that time as well. And you can see how that draws on all of these little aspects as well.
So around that time, obviously, the skies were very dark because of this kind of a lot of thunderstorms, a lot of clouds. And we talked about there was a big explosion, wasn't there? A big volcanic explosion, which caused all sorts of beautiful sunsets and sunrises. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because I know there was some artistry as well, wasn't there, by Turner and so forth. And if you were to look at those paintings, you can see that reflected in the paintings that they drew.
Yeah, so this is another interesting one where we're talking about sky, but sky in a much wider sense, globally. And at that point, you're referring to the eruption of Mount Tambora, and that's a massive eruption. To give you an idea, in the island area where that exploded, you had a population of 27,000. A handful survived. So that's how bad that explosion was. But that was miles away, on the other side of the Earth, you could say. But because it was so substantial, it threw up dust into the high atmosphere, and that caused a substantial change. And we think, with a few other eruptions that happened at the same time, that might have have led to this substantial change in global climate at that point in time as well. But also what it has caused is these amazing glowing sunsets. And this is the bit where we're talking about thunderstorms, clouds, weather. We're also talking about the effects of the reddening near purple skies as the sun rises or sets. And that happened there as well. And Turner being one of them, it's a tricky one to argue if that really was, but it does look tempting. And other Ascot as well, painters captured these amazing sunsets at that time. So again, an inspiration happening there. And you might say that has nothing to do with astronomy, but it's the sky overall. Everything that is in there features. And if it's clouds, if it's the rainbows, if it's thunderstorms, if it's stars, if it's the Milky Way, if it's planets, moon, sun, all of that is part and parcel of our exploration. So it is really a very poignant year, and it's really fascinating to see what could happen at that time as well there.
So can we date kind of things that are happening in the sky at a time of when things are written or when paintings are drawn and captured? Can we actually rewind and actually look at that? Because I know you've got amazing software that we can go back and look at what was happening in the sky at those times.
So that's perfectly possible. It's knowing what is being represented. So if we can identify the objects, like, for example, in Mary Shelley's work, the moon rising over the horizon at a certain time, we can now look into our understanding of the orbital movement of the moon, how long that takes, the path as it seemingly moves through the stars, and can then trace that back, because we can take from alternative sources the date and time. We can look at where that's happened. We have to visit the place to see the lay of the land as well, and then we can wind back the mechanics of celestial motion to sort of see what happens. The moon is a trickier one. It's probably the one where you can't wind it that far back. Hundreds of years, yes, to a certain precision, then it becomes a less precise. If you're going for stars or some planets, it becomes longer. Stars, for sure, we have software that, if we have the ability to work with that at home, we can wind that back to, say, Bronze Age times to see where things rise, how things appear in the sky. And then we can sort of set the scene. We can look at how the sky would look like at that time and then see, does that mirror in some of the writings? So does that feature in the moon and a star close by, as described in one of Byron's poems? And we know that if that's the case, he mistook one of the stars as a planet, which we think is Jupiter, now close to the moon. We can see that, for example, in Mary Shelley's, when she says, after the witching hour, she didn't find any sleep, and then had this utter nightmare, which acted as an inspiration for Frankenstein, awoke and she saw the moon struggling through the sunlight. We know where she was in the Byron's villa. We know where that was, when that could have happened. And we can trace then how the moon sneaks over the horizon. So we can really use planetarium software and our knowledge of the motion of the stars to actually wind back time and see where things would be, and try to now use the sky as an additional way of interpreting.
Take us back to basics then, Dan, because people are fascinated by the sky, still are. And I know that you have a real interest in how people engage with the sky and why people do. Can you tell us a bit about what we see when we look up, certainly, I suppose, into the night sky? Because we're always quite captured by the stars and the moon. And as you say, that presents itself differently depending on clouds and the light that's in the sky that night.
So one of the key things that everybody would be able to explore is the sun. So the sun is one of the key players in the sky, followed closely by then the moon as well. We've got these two, as I would later describe them, as actors that have a certain motion. And knowing how they then move through the sky is regular, predictable, so much so that you could set a calendar to it or a clock. We've done that. So clearly there is a link between these two. And we're talking about this at the time of the past equinoxes. You can see where the sun rises and sets on your horizon. You will notice, especially over this time, how quickly that changes. So you can see the rising and setting of the sun on the horizon changes and can tell you things about seasons. You'll notice as well longer days. You'll also notice the sun going higher in the sky. All these are aspects that we become familiar with. Other parts are then the planets and the stars themselves. And the stars lay out patterns in the sky that we can then interpret, and we can then find constellations like Orion coming out of the winter is a classic one. Or we'll be familiar with the star signs, the zodiac, where the planets then move in that band across. So all of these are interesting in their behavior, and constellations might be certain ones like Ursa Major, the large bear, or Ursa Minor, the small bear that we might be familiar with trying to find the pole star. They are always apparent in the night sky. Others rise and set. Others will never be seen where we are. It all depends on location. So this is all interesting, and the stories we tell about them is also quite fascinating and shows a lot about our understanding as a society. But if you go somewhere else, if you would go to North America or Canada seeing and experiencing First Nations, they would see the same stars as we do. They're more or less at the same latitude, but they make complete different sense out of them. They would not use the Greek mythology to understand the sky. So all of these are connections that we have, but it's quite interesting to see that these are not just patterns that stay fixed. They move in very substantial, specific and personalized ways, you can nearly say. So they're like things that have a character as they move through the sky.
So earlier you were talking about things that have in history where we thought the world was doomed because the sun got spots. Can you elaborate a little bit on the things that do change and why they change and the impacts they have?
It is what we would nowadays call cosmology. So it's the understanding of where we are in the big overall world and distribution of things and where that came from. And that's a bit that I alluded to with the Milky Way, where we're talking about the Milky Way. Not only will it have formed, but it's also going to dissolve in these clusters as they thought at that time, which is completely incorrect as we now understand it, and then dissolve away and nothing's left behind. Now we have the idea of a multitude of galaxies formed in a big bang. What was beforehand? We could ask ourselves, is that the right question even? But that's the kind of understanding of cosmology and how we look into the sky. But that's where I said doom and gloom, yes, but you might think we've put that away, we're looking beyond that. It's still acting as a massive inspiration, standing on a safe earth, looking into the depth of the sky, but it's still there, this kind of spark. If you're thinking about the first walk in space, people, astronauts, walking in nothingness, only separating a few millimeters, protecting them against things that are then out of space, and the danger that it is to explore that. But also the way as we humans explore, you look into the sky and you might see the International Space Station fly over. You might see nowadays the clusters and swarms of Starlink satellites in near-Earth orbits flying over us, and very clearly as a chain regularly zipping over us. So at that point, you might look into the sky and think, where does that lead? Is that just now the first step into populating this clean, seemingly perfect zone into a clutter of space garbage that's just doomed to fall back down onto space and wipe us out? Or if you're thinking about the next step, looking at even now we've got a beautiful comet 12P circling through our solar system. What's with asteroids that are out there that could wipe out the dinosaurs or crash down to Earth and destroy a small city or impact us? But what happens with these? We're keeping an eye on them. But again, it's death and destruction out of space that's lurking there, waiting to strike when we least expect it. And that's found quite a lot of resonance if you just look at Hollywood movies as well, of where we are. And we as scientists work on that, but that still captures that kind of fear that we see. And imminently, I think it boils down to we're here on this small spot on Earth looking into the infinity and the darkness that is there. And what is there? So does that call back to us? What does that really capture in us? And inspiration being one, the sublime, and seeing the danger that's out there while safe in here. And that's, I don't think, has changed from now to in the past.
And so looking sort of ahead into sort of, I guess, more immediate future. Is there change? You've obviously described quite a few bits of why the sky is different to what it was, you know, hundreds of years ago because of satellites and so forth. What might we see coming up that will continue to influence kind of the next lot of artistry or creativity writers?
I think it's the idea of Earth, a sort of our sphere, and at the point where we're talking about with Byron, that sphere would have been earthly for sure. That's changed, obviously. We've set foot on the moon. We are exploring heavily Mars, other planets as well. And we're heavily populating and using, possibly abusing, the near-Earth orbits. And we're exploring and pushing out into the outer space area. So that's the bit where the zone of our own influence is extending. And if that's extending, that changes the game to a certain point as well. It throws aspects open, thinking about space ethics, thinking about space archaeology, and there's interesting aspects that ring then how should we treat other moons that we explore? What do we do with our spacecrafts out there? All aspects that are morally interesting to explore also as a writer and a poet. And the end of the world as we might see it might come in different disguises now. And what we might have then in the past seen as this dangerous zone outside is still dangerous but becomes more everyday. However, there's still aspects outside that then reign this danger, and it's just shifted. I think it's essentially, from a writer's point of view, from an inspirational point of view, the change of our sphere of influence. It's expanding, and we think we have a better understanding, but it's just changing in the view. The other part is the engagement we have with the sky, where in the past you might have gone outside and viewed the sky. You can do that nowadays, but you have to, you face challenges in doing so, to be able to see that, to see the Milky Way, to see millions of stars out there where you could say that's us, but we're so tiny, so non-significant. That's struggling. But so we're not really engaging with the sky, or are we? We are, but just in an indirect manner, because as soon as you head out somewhere to drive, you throw on your GPS, and therefore you create a connection to the night sky, towards whatever is above you. The International Space Station as well. So there's many aspects of it. You're talking about internet capture from satellites. Again, a link in there as well. So there's so many things that we are now linking. Not necessarily directly, but it's an indirect experience. So it's an interesting way how we are now extending our sphere of influence and how we're now engaging with sky. Different, but yet in some way leading to the same aspects of inspiration.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
If you'd like to find out more about Dan's work, please have a look in the episode description. You've been listening to the Research Reimagined podcast by Nottingham Trent University. For all of the latest news from the research community at NTU, follow us on Twitter at @NTU_research, or sign up to our research newsletter by visiting ntu.ac.uk/research. Thanks for listening.